Good morning. Welcome to the Ways and Means Committee. I call this committee meeting to order on, what is today, the 23rd, on the 23rd of February, 2026. This is our first meeting of the year, and we do have a quorum present. I'm going to read through the required decorum document. I'm sure many of you have heard it already, but...
Is your mic on, Mr. Chair?
I don't think so.
It's not on.
Or none of them are?
Hello.
Let's start again here.
Oh, dear. You're all chairs, so you've probably heard this before. Are we on now?
Check.
No, they are on. They are on.
They're just quiet.
Gotta get in there.
It's quiet. Well... Yes, sir. Are we good now?
We should be.
Good. Okay, I'll try again. Call the meeting of the Ways and Means Committee to order on February 23rd, 2026. You know, I have time problems.
This is like deja vu.
Anyway, welcome to the committee meeting. I am going to read through the required decorum document that many of you have already heard in other committees, but I happen to have been in the Public Safety Committee meeting last year when decorum was brutally interrupted, and so I take this somewhat personally. Welcome to the Minnesota House of Representatives. We appreciate your interest and participation in the legislative process. To ensure everyone can view, hear, and understand today's proceedings, we ask for your cooperation in maintaining decorum and civility throughout this hearing. For the safety, security, and comfort of all attendees, please note the following guidelines. I, the committee chair, maintain control of these proceedings and establish the following expectations. Signs and placards are not permitted in the hearing room. Verbal outbursts, shouting, or disruptive behavior will not be tolerated. Applause or other audible demonstrations is not allowed. For safety reasons, standing or sitting in walkways and aisles or standing or obstructing at your chair is prohibited. If you require any accommodation, please speak with our sergeant's staff identified by gold ties. Troopers and house security personnel are present to ensure everyone's safety. Those providing testimony will be given time limits, which must be observed. If you receive an entrance ticket, please retain it as it may be required for re-entry if you leave the hearing room. Failure to comply with these guidelines may result in your removal from the hearing room. Our goal is to conduct these proceedings efficiently while ensuring all the opportunity to observe and participate appropriately. Thank you for your cooperation and participation in the legislative process. Representative Agbaje, would you care to approve the minutes from our last meeting last year?
I'll move the minutes, Mr. Chair.
The minutes have been moved. All those in favor of approving the minutes signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Thank you. I would like to recognize some changes here in the Ways and Means Committee. First off, we have two new members, one of them having to be the co-chair. Before I introduce the new co-chair, I want to recognize the good work that was accomplished last year by the former co-chair, who has had an upgrade, apparently, and but for tragic reasons, as we all know. That will be with us throughout this session and throughout our time in the legislature. Things have happened that should never happen, and it's a shame. But in spite of that, we have work to do, and I do welcome Cedric Frazier, the new co-chair and new member of the committee, and I would like to give him a chance to make some introductory remarks. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. And to the members, I appreciate the opportunity to serve with you all on this committee. I am looking forward to the, even though we have tough work to do, considering the impacts that we're seeing from what's happening at the federal level and also federally right here in our state, some things that we have to try to fill some gaps on and to help some people that have been harmed within our communities. I'm looking forward to doing that work. I know that we oftentimes and many times we see things differently, but I do truly believe that we believe in doing what's best for all Minnesotans. So I'm looking forward to doing that work with you all here in this committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. You may note that both Representative Frazier and I may be limping a little bit this session because of our future is not here in the legislature. We have a new vice chair of the committee. Representative Scott is assuming that position. Welcome, Representative Scott. We appreciate your willingness to serve as vice chair for the Republican side. And finally, we have another new member. Representative Bjorn Olson is joining the committee to put us back at full strength. Welcome, Representative Olson. With that, I think we are prepared to go ahead with our presentations. We have two presentations today regarding the state of Minnesota's economy. We scheduled these presentations prior to this week's release of the February budget forecast so the committee could receive additional information on trends and issues affecting Minnesota. Each presentation should last approximately 30 minutes. We should have a good amount of time for questions at the end of both presentations. Our first presenters are Jennifer Byers and Sean O'Neill from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, presenting on Minnesota's economic imperative for growth. And I will introduce the next presentation when we get to that point. So please identify yourselves for the record and go ahead with your presentation. Welcome to committee.
Good morning, Chair Tokerson, Chair Frazier, and members of the committee. Thanks so much for having us. I'm Jennifer Byers. Sean and I are actually with the Minnesota Chamber Foundation. The foundation is a 501c3 organization, a partner to the Minnesota Chamber, but we are a separate organization. And we have three primary areas of focus. First is Grow Minnesota. It's a business retention and expansion program. We go out and visit with hundreds of companies, members, non-members, across the state every year and provide assistance as they seek to grow and expand in Minnesota. It could be supply chain issues, workforce issues. It's a free service and our commitment to helping companies grow here in the state. The second is workforce development. We have an inclusion program to help employers build inclusive workforces, whether it's hiring veterans, people of color, underrepresented communities. We work with employers across Minnesota to provide resources and also have a substantial partnership with local chambers, connecting students to high-demand careers in their communities, which not only creates a workforce pipeline, but helps young people stay in Minnesota. And finally, the third pillar and why we're here today is economic research. We began this work about 8 years ago, really digging into the performance of Minnesota's economy and producing reports and really recommendations on how to accelerate economic growth. You may have seen the Minnesota 2030 report. There have been a couple versions of that. We dig into specific issues like entrepreneurship, and you may be familiar, a couple years ago we issued a report on Minnesota's environmental permitting timelines, and that data was used by our policy team to pass a reform bill last year. Today we're here to talk about the 2026 business benchmarks. It's a report that we've been producing for 10 years, and we really think it's important to understand the performance of Minnesota's economy over the long haul. And our goal is really to grow the pie for everyone. This isn't just a business issue. As Minnesota economy grows more quickly, it creates greater tax revenue for state and local governments and provides more opportunity for everyone in Minnesota. So with that, let me hand it over to my colleague, Sean O'Neill, who dig into the data, and then we're happy to answer any questions.
Again, thank you, co-chairs Torkelson and Frazier and members of this committee for the opportunity to present to you findings from our 2026 Business Benchmarks Report. You know, this report is in some ways a distillation of key themes that we see repeating across the other research and studies that Jennifer was just describing. We've been producing an annual Business Benchmarks Report for over 10 years now. We have conducted more in-depth research on the longer-term development of the state's economy through our 2030 report, have looked at issues around, around entrepreneurship, immigration, business expansion activity, environmental permitting. So we've done kind of a broader series of studies looking at different issues in the state's economy. And so this report sketches out some of these high-level themes that we see kind of repeating across these studies. And it looks both at areas where Minnesota has some strengths and competitive advantages, as well as where we're lagging behind and face challenges. So before I get into the findings from the report, I just wanted to go a little deeper on what Jennifer was describing around the why behind this economic imperative for growth. You know, why are we focused on economic growth in the first place? And, you know, the economic growth metrics themselves can seem a bit abstract at times, but they are measuring real activity that impacts our communities around the state. And these metrics can give us meaningful insights about how fast incomes are rising, how businesses are investing in their operations and capital equipment, how innovation is taking place in our economy is becoming more efficient, how jobs are growing and the size of our workforce, all of these things which we care about and that impact the health of our communities here in Minnesota. And then additionally, economic growth can bring about some second-level benefits as well. So as our economy grows, it does bring more revenue in at the local and state level, can reduce some of the fiscal strains that we have. You can get these virtuous cycles as the economy grows, where businesses and people often move to places that are already growing. So you can so growth in the economy can kind of attract more investment and more talent attraction into the state as well. And then I think, you know, as our economy grows, it can create a sense of optimism within our communities that our, you know, that our cities, that our state is headed in the right direction. So all of these we think are kind of important to keep in mind as we look at the data on our state's economy. So with that, let me dive into some of the findings from our benchmarks report. And in the report, we describe Minnesota's economy as being at a crossroads. And we say that because we see that we have both a unique set of strengths and opportunities that can be further developed and leveraged, but also some real challenges that need to be addressed for the state's economy to reach its full potential. So first, let me start off with what we see as some of the strengths. And here, the data is clear. We see this consistently as we do these annual benchmarks reports, that for decades, Minnesota has had above average prosperity levels in the state, as measured by high output per person, leading to above average per capita income levels. And this goes all the way back to the early 1970s, where Minnesota has had higher per capita income than the U.S. average. And this economic prosperity that we have in Minnesota has been driven by a combination of two things. One, we have this highly skilled and hardworking workforce. Then we have a very strong set of private sector businesses and leading industries. And on the workforce side, we can see this in measurements like our labor force participation rates, where Minnesota consistently ranks around the top five states in the country for the share of adults that are participating in the labor force. And we tend to have structurally lower unemployment rates than the U.S. economy, whether we're at the top or bottom of a business cycle. So we have a kind of underlying healthy labor market here in the state. And our workforce also has above average education levels. We rank in the top 10 states for the share of our adult population with a 2 or 4 year degree or higher. And this skilled workforce helps drive innovation in the state's economy. Minnesota consistently ranks in the top 5 to 10 states for patents per capita, which is a good kind of broad measure of overall innovation as businesses are creating new products, new ideas, and bringing them to market. Now, the last three items that you see on the screen here speak to the diversity and breadth of our industry sectors in Minnesota. Minnesota is a hub for corporate headquarters. We have 17 Fortune 500 companies that are headquartered here. We have the highest concentration of headquarters jobs in the country. And we have a diverse industry base where we're not overly concentrated in any one industry sector. So that kind of helps build resiliency into the economy. And at the same time, we are a leader in a variety of different industry clusters around healthcare and medical technology, financial services, a variety of advanced manufacturing industries, food and agriculture. And so, you know, having this well-rounded industry base has been an immense strength for the state, both in terms of resiliency and in terms of producing high economic value. Now, at the same time, the data is equally clear that though we have these strengths, our economy has been slowing in recent decades. We've been growing at an average of about 1.5% annually going back to at least 2010, which is well below our long-term average. And the economy is growing slower, not just compared to previous decades, but we've also been growing more slowly than most other states in recent years. And that's part of what we highlight in this 2026 benchmarks report. We look at three fundamental areas of Minnesota's economy where we need to concentrate attention if we want to sustain and build on the strengths that we've developed here over decades. So let me just walk through these three metrics that you see in front of you. First, you know, we think that Minnesota's economy would benefit from faster overall growth, and especially on a per capita basis, on a per person basis. You know, that's really how we grow the economic pie in a way that makes people better off on average, that can increase overall prosperity levels in the state. And in the first half of this decade, our GDP per capita has been growing relatively slowly at just 1% annually, ranking 38th among states. The second metric here is looking at growth in our workforce, in our total labor force. And here, too, our labor force has grown at just 0.2% annually in the first half of this decade, from 2019 to 2024. Now, this is not unique to Minnesota. States around the country are facing similar challenges, but we have been impacted more than some other states. We rank 40th in total labor force growth in the first 5 years of the decade. And then third, if we want to grow the size of our workforce, we're going to have to do more to retain and attract more people to Minnesota. And while international migration has been a net plus over the recent years, domestic migration has been more of a challenge here in the state. We rank 41st in net domestic migration in the, so far this decade, with more people leaving Minnesota than moving to the state. So let me just briefly walk through each of these metrics a little bit more so we can see the trend lines, kind of the longer-term trend lines around each of them. And then I will highlight just a few of what we see as both barriers and opportunities to address these issues. So first, as it relates to GDP per capita, you know, this is one of the first things that economists will look at when they're measuring overall prosperity from one location to another, whether we're looking at different countries, different states. And you know, if you recall the earlier slide with all of the strengths that I listed, the first one on that list was that Minnesota delivers a high economic value per person. And for decades, this has been true. But as our economy has grown slowly and lagged the U.S. average in recent years, this advantage has narrowed. We can see this in the chart that is up here now. What we see in the data is that our GDP per capita is now essentially even with the U.S., so the U.S. has caught up to Minnesota in terms of output per person. And you know, why does this matter? GDP per capita can sound a bit abstract, but it is a broad measure of economic prosperity, and it's correlated with other measures like per capita incomes. So as our GDP per capita has kind of converged to the U.S. average, our per capita incomes have come closer to the U.S. average as well. So our incomes are still growing in Minnesota, the economy is still growing, but that advantage that we've had over the U.S. economy has just narrowed in recent years. So second, let me look more closely here at trends around our labor force growth. Now, in the last quarter of the 20th century, from 1976 to 2000, Minnesota's labor force grew at a pretty healthy rate. It was growing at 1.7% annually. But since 2000, growth in our labor force has really been much more flat. And this has been one of the factors that's constrained growth and job creation and overall economic activity. And this challenge has intensified this decade. A lot of this was due to impacts of the pandemic in 2020 and 2021. Minnesota lost close to 100,000 people in the labor force in that first year of the pandemic, as we had an acceleration of retirements, people leaving the workforce for other reasons. Now, we have regained pre-2020 levels in our labor force, but if you look at that time period from 2019 to 2024, growth has been essentially flat. We've added just about 25,000 people to the workforce in that time. Now, much of this is driven by long-term demographic factors. Minnesota has an aging population. Birth rates have been declining over time. So this has just slowed natural growth in the population. So what does that mean? I think it means that Minnesota has essentially two levers to try to address this challenge. You know, how do we grow our workforce from here? And one is we can try to increase labor force participation rates of people that are already here, help reduce barriers, pull people off the economic sidelines. And this remains a high priority. But given the fact that Minnesota already has among the highest workforce participation rates in the country, there's just not as much room to grow our workforce in that regard. So the second option is that we can retain and attract more people through migration. Now, like I mentioned before, international migration to Minnesota has been a net plus over the past couple decades. This has helped Minnesota sustain population gains, even as other components of population growth have been more limited. Immigration to Minnesota did slow last year, and there are more questions about the near-term outlook here, which is something we'll be tracking closely. But if we look over the past 25 years, Minnesota's challenge has been more on the domestic migration side of this equation. Minnesota's lost more people than we've attracted in 20 of the past 25 years. So while 1 or 2 years of negative migration might not be cause for concern, consistent negative migration does add up over time and can affect the size of our population and our workforce. So as you can see in the chart here, new census data came out just earlier this month showing that Minnesota had net domestic migration gains in 2025, or between the middle of 2024 to the middle of 2025, to be more precise. And so this is welcome news, to be sure. I think the important factor is to see how we can have Minnesota consistently have these types of net gains in domestic migration so that these gains can kind of stack up over time, eventually impacting the size of our population and our workforce. All right, so that's a highlight of just some of the overall trend lines that we point out in the report. Let me look at some of what we see as both of the barriers and the opportunities to address these issues. So first with the barriers, we list a number of issues in the report in kind of each of these metrics, so I encourage you to look through that more closely. But I'll highlight just a few areas that we see, especially on the cost side, that have become growing concerns here in Minnesota in recent years. So first, around our kind of cost of doing business and overall business climate here in the state. Each year, the Tax Foundation ranks states on overall tax competitiveness. And they look at a couple hundred different metrics that look at both headline rates, but also the underlying tax structure for each state in the U.S. And in 2025, they ranked Minnesota as having the 44th most competitive tax environment, making Minnesota kind of an outlier in a region that looks very different from tax perspective. And this is one factor that can impact overall business investment where companies decide to locate or expand their operations. Like Jennifer mentioned, our foundation has a program called Grow Minnesota, where we visit and survey hundreds of companies each year about their activities in the state, where they're growing, where they're looking to invest. And as we've been conducting these surveys, a consistent theme has been that companies can be hesitant to invest here because of this overall cost structure and regulatory environment here in Minnesota. Businesses often face higher operating costs than in other parts of the country. And this can come both in terms of taxes, but also things like electricity prices, healthcare costs, other operating costs like that. And more recently, we've heard an increase in businesses saying that the complexity or the uncertainty in the regulatory environment can be a factor in their expansion decisions. So addressing some of these issues, mitigating costs of doing business, creating more clarity in the regulatory environment, reducing timelines to expand a business here, all of those are ways that we can help unlock more capital investment, more business growth here in Minnesota, both from companies that are already here, as well as companies that might be looking at siting new projects here in the state. Now, these issues around cost and affordability impact not just business decisions, but it also might influence where individuals and households decide to live and work. And the data show that most people who move to another state don't move across the country, but they just move to another state within their existing region. They move to a neighboring state. And so for that reason, it's useful to think about our competitiveness for population, for talent, within a regional context. Minnesota's overall cost of living is higher than our neighboring states. We're not the most expensive state in the country. We rank 31st in terms of affordability, according to data from the Bureau of Economic Analysis. But we do sit in a region with some of the most affordable states in the U.S. South Dakota ranks 3rd. North Dakota 6th, Iowa 7th, and Wisconsin 21st. And because we know from census data, from reporting from the state demographer, that a lot of our domestic migration outcomes are driven by college-age young adults, makes sense to look at things like college affordability. And here, Minnesota ranks 40th in college tuition and fee affordability. So this is just one data point. More research is needed to kind of fully understand these factors. But I think that this kind of points at some issues that we can be looking at as potential levers to lower the barriers for people to stay or move to Minnesota. And then additionally, having an adequate supply of available housing is another necessary component to support more population growth here in the state. And this continues to be a constraint for Minnesota, where we rank 48th nationally in growth of new housing starts so far this decade. This chart shows census data on new housing permits, comparing Minnesota to the U.S. And while Minnesota is following the same general trend line as the U.S., you can see that new housing activity fell off more sharply after 2022 here than in the U.S. as a whole. So again, this is something for us to kind of look further into, try to better understand, and figure out how we can support healthier housing construction so we have that availability at the community level to grow our population. So I just want to end here with what we see as some of the opportunities for Minnesota ahead. And we do think that Minnesota is positioned well to compete for investments across a broad range of different sectors. We have some competitive advantages that make Minnesota an attractive place for companies to invest in things like AI and data center investment, advanced manufacturing. We have an incredible natural resource base here with emerging clean tech industries that are starting to be further cultivated. We have an amazing food and agriculture sector in the state, a leading medical and life sciences sector. All of these are real advantages in the state's economy that also align with growth markets. And we see these as opportunities to be further built upon, further cultivated, so that companies can invest and expand within these sectors. And then it's important to note that great businesses can come in any sector. So it's great to look at where we have leading industries, but just helping support entrepreneurs, businesses in any sector is one of the ways that we can really foster healthy growth in the economy going forward. Now, these aren't just hypothetical opportunities. We do have companies that are already investing in activities and new operations here in the state. This slide shows just some news clippings from recent expansion announcements in things around R&D, advanced manufacturing, med tech. Each year, Minnesota has around 100 of these types of expansion announcements. But again, we feel that given our strengths, Minnesota is just scratching the surface of the true potential here and the opportunities that we have ahead. And it's not just large economic development projects that we see as opportunities. Since the middle of 2020, we've noted a pretty strong uptick in new business formation. So this chart shows new business applications. Many of these will remain small businesses, but some of them intend to grow and scale up. And so to the extent that we can create that environment here in Minnesota for these entrepreneurs to access the capital they need, the talent, the business support to be successful here, this could be one of the factors that helps add more growth and dynamism to the state economy going forward. All right, so I'll wrap up here. I think what we see in this report, and again, these are themes that are consistent in our other research, is that Minnesota does still have considerable economic strengths, and we really feel that we could be a leader in the next wave of economic development. But at the same time, the data is clear that growth has been slowing in Minnesota and that we've been lagging the national average across some key measures of economic growth. And we see this impeded by some challenges in Minnesota's business climate, some challenges in our talent attraction and net migration, especially within a regional context. So addressing these issues, we think is imperative going forward. The Chamber Foundation is working on a report right now looking and trying to outline some strategies for growth, some things that we think could really help unlock more activity in the economy. So we'll be putting that out later this spring and continuing to work with stakeholders, businesses, economic development leaders around the state in the months to come. So I will end there and happy to take any questions you have.
Well, thank you, Mr. O'Neill, for your presentation. I do have some questions. First, Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you to the Chamber Foundation for doing this. This information, I think, is really vital for us as policymakers to, you know, dive into what is driving our economic engine, which, again, we are so lucky to have so many headquarter companies here in Minnesota, the highest in the country per capita. This is critical for us. And again, these trends are important, and I've always appreciated the numbers. Grow Minnesota. I want to go back to Grow Minnesota for a minute. My good friend Bill Blazer got that thing off the ground a long, long time ago. And back in my district, before I was a legislator, I was on the local chamber, we would go to these visits, to business visits, and we would ask them just organically, tell us what's working in Minnesota, what's not. We would thank them for doing business in Minnesota because they don't have to do it here. I, at that time, really engaged a lot. Your information here, what I heard was several hundred businesses have been visited over the time, at least in each year. What are you hearing now, if I could get an update, on what are we hearing from our small, medium, and large businesses around the state as an aggregate? What are the two, three items that they're really now super concerned about? Is it taxes? Is it mandates? I guess we need to kind of hear this because that is, I think, the best way to hear how businesses are feeling in Minnesota. What are you hearing now in the last few months here?
Yeah, thank you for the question, Representative. And we do so, like you described, we both do one-on-one visits and also surveys with companies around the state. And some consistent themes that we've heard on issues at the local and state level especially. So there's all sorts of things that impact, you know, business performance beyond the context of the state. You know, we do try to focus on some of the state level issues where we can have more influence. And the themes that have really been at the top of the list in recent years have been around regulatory complexity, especially for small and medium-sized businesses. This is something that has become more prevalent just in the past couple of years, that companies are spending a lot more time than they have in the past trying to understand regulatory compliance, having to put in place new systems, trying to think about different ways of managing their workforce. This can sometimes come in the form of permitting challenges when a company needs an air or water permit to expand a facility here, and there can be some complexity around those issues. So that has been really a key thing that has come out through these visits and the survey work. And then taxes and workforce availability have been very consistent themes. When we do surveys asking what's your biggest barrier to grow your business here, having the available workforce and having a competitive tax structure are two things that consistently rank at the top of that list for barriers. So there's all sorts of other things that can come up that might be specific to the business, but those are three of the most common themes that we've been hearing.
Follow-up, Representative Biggs.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you again. And I'm hearing a lot of the same, but actually more detailed about some of the break law changes that were recently done, and maybe paid family medical leave, where they've got specific concerns or, you know, state laws to follow when it comes to training people, certain trades in the industry. Paid family is still brand new to all of us. We're still trying to understand how this will affect us. There are a lot of people out of work right now, out of the workforce, because of this new rule and new law. But this is something that we need to understand better. But again, hearing these firsthand is a major concern. My last comment would be, or on this question anyway, when I was recently in California with a number of headquarter companies with the University of Minnesota, we're talking about some investments that we need to do in Minnesota with the high-tech industry and how we can take advantage of our corporate companies that are here, have invested, have planted their stakes here, have real concerns also about non-compete and how it was recently changed, and just a broad statement. Are you hearing some concerns around non-compete as well as, like, just, again, paid family medical leave to the degree that affects certain size businesses different?
Mr. O'Neill.
Thank you for the question. Through our Grow Minnesota program, I have not heard as many direct comments about that. Now, we have been gaining input from businesses through other focus groups, other mechanisms where I think those issues have been focused on more. So I don't have direct experience talking with companies about that issue specifically. I don't know if you have anything that you want to add.
Yeah, Chair Torkelson and Representative Baker. I will say that we have heard more specifically about paid family leave. It is clearly top of mind as we talk to companies and clearly through our local chamber partners as well. We're hearing more, and as you say, it's early. So I think we are assessing their experience, and I think we'll be able to share more with you. But clearly, as implementation has taken place, we are hearing more about the issue and concerns about moving forward.
Thank you. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just another kind of follow-up to that, you know, I've heard some anecdotal from just my hospitals, and when they're trying to recruit talent, they have to increase that package by 7% to 10% if they're trying to move someone from out of state here. Are there other areas, or have you heard any other kind of along those lines trying to recruit kind of top talent, and if areas of struggle with some of those things when it comes to pay and resource and complexity?
Mr. O'Neill?
Thanks for the question. That is absolutely a concern that we hear about from companies, is the ability to attract top talent from other parts of the country. It can be very case specific depending on the business, the type of people that they need to recruit. But there are factors that it can either be related to the tax environment, also in areas of greater Minnesota, having the housing availability, having the right job opportunities for a spouse or family member. Those can all be factors that can constrain our ability to attract talent to the state. So that is something that comes up, again, both in survey data and visits with companies.
Follow-up, Representative Swazinski.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a kind of a secondary question, kind of looking at, you know, we over the last few years, we've seen a giant increase in the size of government from state spending, you know, from a job creation, from a government efficiency standpoint, you know, have businesses seen any benefit from that increase in spending? Kind of what would be the reaction, would you say, you know, generally out there from that?
Mr. O'Neill.
You know, I don't know if I can speak directly to that question in a broad sense. So I think that businesses would be impacted differently based on maybe a specific area of spending. So hard for me to kind of categorize that broadly.
Representative Nash, did you have another question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yep. And then just kind of follow up, you know, one of the conversations that's happening kind of nationwide, whether it be Florida, South Dakota, North Dakota, is property taxes. And you know, we obviously saw a lot of mandates come down from the state. I think there was like 280 mayors or something that signed a letter kind of complaining to the governor and the legislature about, you know, that increase in mandate, increase in costs, essentially from that standpoint. You know, what, you know, do you guys have some ideas that you've thought about when it comes to property tax relief or things from the local level that could be a benefit to your businesses, both large and small, regardless of profitability?
Mr.
Chair Torkelson,
we normally go through the chair. I know it's been a long time since the chamber's been here, so you're forgiven. But Ms. Byers.
Yeah, Chair Torkelson, Representative Swazinski. You know, that is not our, we have not dug into the property tax system here. That would be our colleague Brian Cook's area of responsibility. I think, though, we are concerned about rising costs, and we have seen the mandates drive up costs not only for businesses but local governments and school districts. And I think that is the objective of our work around the economic imperative, is that if the economy is growing more quickly, it generates more tax revenue and maybe makes tighter budgets less of a problem. So a more quickly growing economy really makes it easier for everyone to be in Minnesota.
Thank you. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifiers, you pointed out, as did Doug Loon, who came out to my district to do a breakfast presentation of this report, that we are 44th in the nation in tax competitiveness. And I'm just wondering if you could, or if the data shows a correlation between the increase in taxes, increase of fees, increase of the lack of ease to enter the business world, if there's a correlation there, and also as another data point in the correlative data that you look at, the precipitous wealth drain that we've seen in the state of Minnesota. So sort of an inflection point of the last 4 years of tax policy and other policies having a direct impact on the competitiveness of the state of Minnesota, because those are the sorts of things that you need to look at from a legislator's perspective to make corrective efforts. And certainly, you just can't say, well, we're no longer as competitive as we used to. Gosh, that's bad. There have to be numbers behind all that. So if you would please maybe detail some of those things, particularly in the areas that I'd asked for.
Mr. O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. As it relates to migration of wealth across state borders, you know, there is IRS data that you can track to look at to get answers around some of those questions. That's not something that we've investigated in depth. Other organizations like the Center for Fiscal Excellence have done some studies around that. My understanding of the literature there, the data there, is that Minnesota tends to do better on the retention side and worse on attraction, and that has had an impact on wealth migration from a state-to-state level. So I think that is certainly something that we want to be tracking more closely, is looking at a more detailed level around migration. We can look at things around age demographics, state-to-state migration flows, so we can understand what states are we attracting people from, where are we losing people to, looking at other economic studies, looking at some of the kind of factors around that. All of those are important for us to better understand, and I think that we're, you know, just starting to kind of understand some of the components around the wealth migration part of that.
Follow-up, Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a quick follow-up and a corollary to Representative Swedzinski's question. I meet regularly with the CEO of the hospital that is in my district. It's the largest employer in Carver County. And the fear that they have is the confiscatory costs that they're going to have relative to paid family medical leave. Both, how do they attract labor to begin with, but what is the impact on their ability to deliver care? You know, I know that is something you've looked at, and you hear regularly from it, and that was the predominant topic of conversation at our hour-long meeting was. And these were all either managing directors or CEOs that were at our meeting, and their fear is that the ability to deliver service is going to be greatly impacted by the number of weeks that someone is able to be gone and their inability to attract or retain people who can do that work. Can you detail a little bit more on the specifics that you've been researching on that area?
Mr. O'Neill.
Yeah, thank you, Chair and Representative. You know, I can share maybe one or two just little case studies or examples from companies that we visited. I was meeting with a mid-size manufacturer that competes with other, other firms around the U.S., and it cost them over $200,000 to overhaul their management systems to comply with new labor mandates. And they're in a very low margin industry. They have real challenges around workforce recruitment and training. And so they did say that this is one of the things that can just make it harder for them to compete with other similar companies in other parts of the state. And so it's one factor of many that influences their business's operations. They said they're not going anywhere, but it just makes it harder for them to be successful and to invest more in equipment, in productivity, in workforce training, all of these other things that they want to be able to spend their resources doing. They've just had less capacity to do as they've had to comply with some of these new mandates. So I think that reflects similar comments that we hear from other businesses that, again, especially for ones that are smaller, mid-sized businesses, and ones that have either locations elsewhere or compete with businesses around the country.
Thank you. I'm just going to remind both members and our testifiers that we do have another presentation coming, so if we can keep our questions concise and our answers a little more brief, that would be greatly appreciated. I have a number of members on the list. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being here this morning. I wanted to drill down a little bit on the workforce participation rate, which seems to be high, right, for compared to the rest of the country. If you know how many, what percentage of those job participants are just part-time employees, or what percentage of that number?
Mr. O'Neill.
Thank you for the question. I don't have that statistic off the top of my head. So there is, we can look at data through the Department of Employment and Economic Development and Bureau of Labor Statistics that counts part and full-time jobs by the job. We could look at census data potentially through the individual level, but I just don't have that data point on hand to be able to cite.
Follow-up, Representative Scott.
Yeah, thank you. Okay. The other, just maybe a statement to prove out what you have here regarding our standing with higher education. And I was surfing through channels briefly last night and learned that in Florida, in-state tuition is $6,300. And I know it's considerably more than that here in the state of Minnesota. And I just, this is more of a statement, but if we want to continue to have an educated workforce, we have to make higher education more affordable to folks. So I don't know what our average is. Maybe somebody in the room does. If Representative O'Neill was here, I'm sure she could tell us. But $6,300 is a pretty decent number, I would fair wager to say. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Representative Koznick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on the presentation that you mentioned, economic growth is slowing over time, and I'm wondering about job growth that kind of goes with that. I know the healthcare sector is doing very well. Are other sectors growing, or which ones are growing aside from healthcare? In the private sector side, but then compared to public sector growth in government jobs, and is there a stronger economic impact and stronger innovation, kind of a synergy in one sector or another?
Mr. O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. So we can look at that both in terms of short-term job growth over the past year and medium-term job growth over this decade. And in both cases, a lot of the job creation in Minnesota has been through healthcare and social assistance. It's our largest employment sector in the state, and it has been the driver of overall job growth, both in the short and more medium term. We've also seen job gains in the construction sector over the first half of this decade, professional services. So there have been other private sector industries that have had job growth overall. Some that have had negative job growth, have had job losses. We do feel that the job gains have been pretty uneven across industries, and we'd like to see there be more broader job growth across these private sector industries so it's not too concentrated in one sector.
Very quickly, Representative Koznick.
Yeah, thank you. I that's kind of what I was seeing in the data as well, because your previous slide talked about a diverse economy that has traditionally strengthened Minnesota overall. And so I have concerns when the public sector is growing better than a lot of other sectors. And just real briefly, you talked about in the manufacturing and AI. Are there net opportunities for something like autonomous vehicles and having that investment in Minnesota?
Mr. O'Neill.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that there's a number of emerging technology sectors that Minnesota's positioned well for. That might be one of them, given some of the existing strengths that we have around different parts of the automotive supply chain, civil engineering, a variety of other industries that could allow us to compete for an industry like that. So I think that's absolutely the type of opportunity that we should be looking at.
Thank you. I apologize in advance to those who have asked a question. I'm not going to be able to get to everyone. A couple more questions. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in respect for time, I'll kind of whittle it down. I have a ton of questions. I don't know when I guess I'll kind of focus on the most current and recent kind of thing that I'm thinking about. So I don't know when your report, I didn't catch exactly when it was done, but it just seems like the tariff environment that we're in right now, that would just greatly impact the efforts that we have in Minnesota with the agricultural markets. You mentioned med tech, and certainly, you know, I represent like the East Metro, and I haven't been, 3M hasn't reached out to me, but I can't imagine how they try to figure out the world market as it, the tariffs are on and off again, and, you know, it just seems so, I don't know, unpredictable. I mean, I think businesses thrive in predictability, and it just is, it's just, it's shocking. And then the other day, you know, the Supreme Court came out with their deal, and, you know, which I support, you know, well, but then all of a sudden there's a blink on, or he's going to, the president's going to do another tariff, and then like the next day I think he came up with another number. So I don't know how businesses can figure it all out, you know, whether it's a big business or a small business. And I was just disappointed to see that you don't seem to, that didn't make any of the slides that I saw, but I just can't imagine that's not a factor for, you know, big or small businesses in our state and trying to figure out. It's probably the biggest thing, quite honestly. I mean, yes, I get it, we're state legislators and the things that we do impact, you know, taxes and other things. But right now, the, you know, when they go into the work every day, the tariffs have got to just be the, you know, the ball they're trying to push up the hill or down the hill. Anyways, I would like to hear if you have a comment on that.
Mr. O'Neill.
Chair and Representative, just to try to briefly address that that question, absolutely, tariffs, trade policy play a big role in, you know, in our economy and in our business performance. You know, our report does focus more on local and state level issues. That's just the scope of our organization and our research. So we don't, we didn't spend as much time focusing on, you know, interest rates, tariff and trade policy, other things within the federal or the national economy that do impact business outcomes. So that's just the reason for the omission in this report. We do focus on that topic. We have other information out on our website around trade and exporting. So it's something that we do work on, but this report itself is focused more on kind of state-level issues.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to thank you for such a comprehensive report and also looking at the areas that we're doing well as well as the areas we could produce some growth. My follow-up question was going to be about tariffs and immigration enforcement, especially in our ag sector and construction. But I'm wondering why you might have only picked, seems like GDP is the majority of what you're looking at for your indicators. And, you know, we talk a lot about business employee retention here because businesses need that stability. There's other indicators, though, that put us in a really good standing with retention that I know can sometimes be contradictive to how much it costs a business because it's employee wages. But we're 15th in per capita income, we're 8th in hourly wage, we're 5th in the highest of 5-year survival rate, which shows the stability that some of our markets have. So I'm just curious, what beyond just GDP did you look at when you looked at your calculations?
Mr. O'Neill or Ms. Byers? Mr. O'Neill.
Yeah, thank you, Chair and Representative. Yeah, the three main metrics that we're looking at in this report is GDP per capita, then also growth in the labor force and migration. So we do try to really look at the highest level activity within our economy, our labor force, our population. So we're not really just focused on GDP narrowly. We are looking both at the output, but also the labor force side of our economy.
Thank you. Representative Frazier, a wrap up on this before we move to the next presentation.
Chair, if I can, because I can, my question that I have can actually go to the next presentation as well. So if I can, I'll yield to, I think Rep. Pinto was on the list, so I'll yield to Rep. Pinto.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks to the presenters. One question, impact of federal immigration enforcement on our economy. I know that you referenced the need. Of course, we know there's such a worker shortage, the need for entrepreneurship. We know entrepreneurship rates are especially high among our immigrant communities. And so I wonder if you can comment on the impact, both long-term, but then, of course, we know the last couple months, a massive negative economic impact that our communities have experienced. Can you talk about that?
Mr. O'Neill.
Chair and Representative, I can't speak to the short-term economic impact in terms of data, it's been too recent, and we just don't have the numbers to fully evaluate that. We did put out a report last year looking at the overall economic contributions of immigration to Minnesota, where we detail a lot of findings through census data, especially on just overall immigration trends and what that means in our labor force for entrepreneurship, other areas of economic activity. So we'd be happy to refer you or send you information on that report.
Okay. Line two.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And
very quickly, Representative Pinto.
Okay. And I know in the short run, I believe there's a report indicating more than $200 million in economic impact in Minneapolis alone in terms of the short run. But appreciate, I know the chamber's come out, I believe, in favor of a comprehensive immigration reform and doing much more in that area, which I really appreciate. I had a couple other things, Mr. Chair, but it sounds like need to move on, I'm gathering.
I'm sorry, I'm running out of time.
Okay.
I would like to thank the chamber. If you have other questions for the chamber, I think you can reach them. I don't know if they'll be sticking around today after the meeting or not, but please feel free to reach out to the chamber if you have other questions on their presentation. Thank you again for being with us today. We do appreciate your attendance at the meeting. I'll next call up Mr. Phelan from the American Experiment. Members, while he's getting set up, a couple of things I neglected to do at the beginning. One was to give Representative Frazier a chance to introduce his CLA.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to introduce Emma Erdo.
Please stand. We want to see who you are. Welcome to the Ways and Means Committee, Ms. Erdo. I appreciate that. And we also have new pages. Harry Hust, is Harry here? There he is. Harry, welcome to the Ways and Means Committee. I might butcher this, but Kay Ann Corder over there. Welcome, Kay Ann. And did I say your name right, by the way? Kay Ann. I knew I'd butcher it. Sorry, I should have checked with you ahead of time. And finally, Mira Van Hunnick over there. Welcome to the Ways and Means Committee. We look forward to working with you, all three of you, through the session. Thanks for your interest in the Minnesota Legislature. With that, Mr. Phelan, are you ready to go?
Ready as I'll ever be, yeah. My name is John Phelan. I'm an economist at Center of the American Experiment. We're a think tank based in Minnetonka, and we focus primarily on state policy across a range of areas. I'd like to thank you all for the invite to come and talk to you today. It's always fun and always informative, and I hope that we can have sort of informative discussion on all this now. The discussion I'm going to have today is based on this report here. Accounting for growth, it's kind of a dense thing. I did leave as many copies as I could find in our office lying around outside in a box. So if you want to pick one up and have a read, a lot of what I'm going to talk about, because I'm kind of constrained for time, I'm going to try and skip over a lot of the method stuff, and that's all laid out in detail in here. So pick one of those up, and if there aren't any left, it's all on our website, and you can download it and print it off. But that's basically what we're going to talk about. What I'm going to talk about and focus mostly on, and this might disappoint people looking for discussion of broader metrics, but we can come to those in the questions, is per capita gross domestic product. There's a reason for this, which I shall explain. But this here is just to give you an idea of the framework of my presentation. We're going to talk about growth accounting. This is where we examine the components of per capita economic growth. Then we'll talk about human capital, which is raw labor and knowledge capital. Those are the two very important buckets you can dump the components into. Then there's physical capital. That's what most people think of when they think of capital, tools and machinery, things like that, buildings, etc. And then total factor productivity, which I will explain a bit more when we get to that point. And then we will come to some kind of high-level conclusions at the end. So I'm going to kind of feed off some of what was in the previous presentation in terms of GDP per capita. It's a key measure of economic welfare. It can sound kind of esoteric. A lot of people sit there and say, I've never heard anybody talk about GDP per capita when they're deciding where to live. But it is correlated with lots of other variables like personal income growth, household income growth, and things like that, which do have more of a kind of immediate impact on how people are doing. Minnesota's recent performance on this measure has not been good, as you've seen in the last presentation. I kind of look at a more narrow period than they did. You'll see that Minnesota had a premium, so to speak, over the United States generally in terms of per capita GDP, which is to say that if you looked at per capita GDP in Minnesota, compared it to the national level, Minnesota's was generally higher. You'll see that this premium was $4,658 per Minnesotan. This is in inflation-adjusted dollars. And that was in 2014. By 2024, the most recent year for which we have data, that had fallen to just $239 per Minnesotan. So that's quite a slowdown. This chart here gives you some kind of illustration of that. So you can see that even on a bad year in the late 90s, we still had kind of a $2,000 per Minnesotan premium. But you'll see that really since 2014, it's just a nosedive. It's gone way down, so something has gone a bit skew-if over that period. In fact, Minnesota's per capita GDP growth has lagged that of the United States in 9 of the last 10 years. If it makes anybody feel any better, the only state that's done worse is Wisconsin, who lagged the United States growth rate in every one of the last 10 years. So there's something at least. This chart kind of shows you that. You'll see that before 2014, we kind of broke even with the national rate. Those are the years highlighted in gray, when our per capita growth rate and GDP was above that of the United States, and the years in black are the years when it was below. So you'll see that before 2014, you know, some years above, some years below, but since 2014, we've almost always been below. So the key question there is why? That was something that I set out to explore. I just said to you, I held up a copy of that report, which you can find out there. That report is really not all that original, I have to say. I am basically utilizing a method laid out in a book called Fully Grown by an economist called Dietrich Vollrath. It's an excellent book. If anybody is interested in macro and growth policy, I would really recommend you have a read of it. But basically all I've done is take his method that he applied to national economies and apply it to the data for state economies so that you can break down the rate of GDP per capita growth and see what's driving it. The technique he uses is called growth accounting. And this is a technique that economists use to break down the observed growth rate in real per capita GDP into its various components. And these components are, so you'll see here, that there's some kind of symbols in here. Don't worry, this isn't math heavy at all. So the growth rate in real per capita GDP, Y, comes from three components. Those are human capital, and that's the quantity and quality of labor provided in an economy. The second source is growth of physical capital, which is the tools those workers have to work with. And the third source is a growth in total factor productivity, which is the efficiency with which these inputs are combined. Sometimes there's a shorthand way you can think of it as innovation and entrepreneurship. You had a 6% growth in real GDP. You could say 2 percentage points came from human capital, 2 percentage points from growth in physical capital, and 2 percentage points from growth in total factor productivity. This here is the only equation in this whole presentation, I promise you, but it basically says that the growth rate of real per capita GDP is a sum of the growth rate in per capita human capital, per capita physical capital, and per capita TFP. With all that, out there, and then we can apply that to the data. This is kind of jump ahead a wee bit. This is really the kind of main findings. I'm doing a report that will be out hopefully soon where I look at Minnesota's economy using this method and data. And this shows you how Minnesota's economic growth is compared to that of the United States over that period since 2014 when our per capita GDP growth has lagged. You'll see that over this period, per capita GDP growth for the United States averaged 1.9% a year, whereas in Minnesota it was 1.1%. So we had a deficit there of 0.8 percentage points. And you can see as you go across that line there what accounts for that deficit. You'll see that in terms of human capital, Minnesota basically stagnated. There was no growth in per capita human capital over that whole 10 years. You'll see that we had a 0.4% average growth rate of physical capital over this period, which was 3 percentage points below the national rate. And you'll see that whereas total factor productivity grew by 1% a year for the United States, it grew by 0.7% annually on average for Minnesota. You'll see across the bottom there where Minnesota ranks on each of those. So 38th out of 50 states for GDP per capita growth, 44th out of 50 states for human capital, 39th for physical capital, and relatively healthy 28th in terms of total factor productivity. But the key point here is that Minnesota has lagged the national growth rate for each source of per capita GDP growth between 2014 and 2024. So that just raises another question, why? So that's when we start to use the data to dig into these estimates of human and physical capital and all the rest of it. Human capital, like I say, it accounts for none of Minnesota's growth since 2014. As I say, it stagnated. And then accounts for 28% of that per capita GDP growth deficit with the United States. As I say, human capital is the quantity and quality of labor provided in an economy. So if we break that down to look at kind of two broad categories, one is raw labor. So that's just the kind of sheer amount of work done in, an economy. And I estimate that using Volvass method as total employment multiplied by the average hours worked annually. And that gives you the total number of hours worked in Minnesota in a given year. So like I said, that's your raw labor component. Then there's what I call knowledge capital. So for each hour that's worked, you can augment that by increased skills applied during the hour. And that's really where knowledge capital comes from. And that comes from two sources. That's the per worker skills arising from education and the per worker skills arising from experience. Now, because of all this, you're able to do a similar kind of growth accounting exercise for human capital, and that's what this table here is. This shows you this, the weighted and unweighted thing is explained in the method report. I shan't take up any time here explaining it. But you'll see that over this period, human capital per capita grew in the United States by an average rate of 0.6% annually, whereas it declined at a rate of 0.1% annually in Minnesota. You'll see that the employment ratio, so that's employment divided by the population, because we're looking at per capita numbers here. In the United States, it grew by 0.5%. Minnesota, it stagnated. Average annual hours worked stagnated in the U.S., declined in Minnesota. The average skills arising from education per worker increased at an average rate of 0.2% annually over this period, which was twice the rate in Minnesota, 0.1% annually. And experience per worker, we actually did better than the national rate there, where we stagnated, whereas across the country it declined at a rate of 0.1% annually. And you'll see down the bottom there the ranks, 44, 45, 32, 47, and 20 is our best one. So we're lagging on a few of these here. None of them really do we, apart from the last one, do we crack the top half of the 50 states. So just to say, Minnesota lagged the national growth rate for three of the four sources of per capita human capital growth. So let's dig a bit deeper. First, we'll look at raw labor. Minnesota's rate of employment growth, because if you think the employment ratio here is employment divided by the population, Minnesota's rate of employment ratio growth is slower than in 44 other states. So this is the growth rate of the ratio, and you can see that here. You've got way down the bottom there, you've got North Dakota. They had the slowest growth over this period. And it's Arizona and Utah at the other end, which had the fastest growth rate in their ratio. And Minnesota's down there with rounding, it's like 0.0%. So we kind of stagnated on the employment ratio growth. Now, as I say, the employment ratio is just employment divided by population. So it follows from that that if you're seeing your employment ratio change, it's because the level of employment or the level of the population has changed. And you see that with Minnesota. So you'll see here, this chart, unfortunately, is perhaps not the clearest, but what you do see is that Minnesota's growth rate of population, 0.6% annually on average, was exactly the same, more or less, as its growth rate of employment. So the employment ratio obviously went nowhere. And you can see that that differs, that performance across different states. You can see that Minnesota's rate of population growth ranked 19th out of 50 states, whereas our rate of employment growth ranked 32nd. Can we drive faster per capita human capital and GDP growth from this source? I don't know that we can. Minnesota's got a lot less scope to drive growth from this source, I think, because we already have a very high employment ratio relative to most other states. You see that here. Minnesota, again, it's the red bar up there. And so what you'll see is a state like way down the end there, West Virginia, where they have a very low employment ratio, they probably could drive faster per capita GDP growth by increasing that rate, that ratio. That scope's not really there in Minnesota because we're already kind of high up. This is employment as a share of the civilian non-institutional population. So this is kind of a more familiar metric than dividing by the population. But you'll see here, you know, we're way up there. Now, if you think to yourself that there's some kind of upper level in terms of the share of your population that's going to be employed, we are probably bumping up against that, I think. It's not going to be 100%, obviously, probably anywhere. But if you look at, like, the top ones here, North Dakota, South Dakota, they're not much higher than ours at, like, 67-point-something%. So I think that when you get up to about that level, like 67% or so, you're bumping up against some kind of natural level, some natural limit, right? It's interesting to note this, by the way. When you look at these states, look at the states around us, the other kind of high-ranking states in terms of employment ratios, it's North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa's a couple below us. So there's a kind of real regional component to this. What that is, I don't really know, but if anybody has any suggestions, I'm all ears. So basically what we've got there is Minnesota had the fifth highest share of its population employed in 2024, which is a real source of economic strength for the state, but it is one that we're about maxing out. You know, you cannot increase, I don't think, you can reasonably increase your employment ratio much above like 67-point-something%. And once you hit that rate, then you're tapped out. You know, your pedal's to the metal on that one. The next component of raw labor is average hours worked annually. Now, I don't say anything about this because my aim is not to have people working longer hours. If you look back over the last, you know, couple hundred years, the story really is that people work fewer hours. You know, the average hours worked declines fairly consistently over the whole period. And I personally think that's what we want to see. What we want to see is higher standards of living with more time to kind of, you know, do other things you would prefer to do perhaps a bit more. So I don't talk about the average hours worked annually, except that it's part of the math that you need to make the whole thing work. So there you go. So let's move on to knowledge capital now. This is the quality of the labor being performed in an economy. And as I say, it's augmented by skills arising from education or experience. The per worker skills arising from education in Minnesota rose by 0.1% annually between 2014 and 2024, which is half the national rate and below that in 46 other states. The full method for how I calculate this, as I say, is in that report. If anybody kind of has a real curiosity about that, catch me afterwards. It's not a short answer. But this chart here shows you, as I say, the average annual change in per worker skills arising from education. It basically rose in every state, but we were way down there towards the bottom of it. So that's not great. You'll see that we were just one of 10 states where the share of the workforce with less than a regular high school diploma rose over this period. That was a performance worse than in 47 other states. So this is, I think, an interesting thing to note, because if you remember a few years ago when Foxconn was shopping around for money, basically taxpayers' money, and they were told to take a hike by Mark Dayton, quite rightly, I think, and he was told, what do you offer? What does Minnesota offer to businesses like this? And he said, we offer them an educated workforce. And this shows, I think, this chart that you see here so that that is a bit less the case than it once used to be. The share of our workforce with less than a regular high school diploma is increasing, and we are one of the few states where that is the case. So what can we do about this? Just to put that in context, is there any scope for growth here? Because remember, there's a difference between growth rates and levels. If you look at the levels, Minnesota ranks 12th out of 50 states for its average per worker level of skills arising from education. You can see that there. You see that Massachusetts ranks top. Nevada's way down the bottom there. So we actually are still, on average, one of the more highly educated workforces in the United States. I mean, we want to keep that. You know, so it's a question of how we keep that. So there's something to think about perhaps when we come to the end of the presentation and think about questions. There is scope, I believe, for our state to drive faster human capital and per capita GDP growth from this source, given the decline in the last few years. Move on to the second component of knowledge capital now, which is the per worker skills arising from experience. Now, this stagnated in Minnesota over our period, which was still a better performance than you saw for the United States generally, and it was above the performance of 30 other states. You can see this chart here shows you the average change. You can see that Washington and Oregon did very, very well there. New Hampshire and Hawaii much less well. Again, the full explanation of how I arrive at these estimates of these things is in the report. But what I would say is that the share of Minnesota's workforce aged between 25 and 44, this is the peak years of skills derived from experience, and I say this as somebody just aged out of this group, fell by 1.5% annually between 2014 and 2024. I perhaps have to say a little bit about the method here. What you do is you award, you divide the workforce up into age groups, you award each age group a score, a per worker score, so then you sum up in the age group the number of workers in that age group, and then you multiply that across all age groups for a state, that gives you your annual thing, then you do that basically for every state for every year. And so what you see is basically the score increases in every age category up to, I think it's 35 to 44, and then it decreases after that as you become set in your ways. And actually the skills from experience can become a drag. And again, I say this as somebody who's now in that group. So you can see here the percentage point change in the share of the workforce in these kind of peak experience skills productivity years. Minnesota's kind of in the middle there, because in the very highest ranked category, which is 35 to 44, we recorded very impressive growth. But on the next highest categories either side of that, we actually did pretty badly. And so the two kind of net off, which gives us that kind of middling performance. Our level of per worker skills derived from experience is below 17 other states. That does mean we're above a bunch of other states. So this, again, is somewhere else where we're doing okay and we could look to do better. So this is something else that we need to look at. There is scope for our state to drive faster human capital and per capita GDP growth here. So this is a kind of overall look at human capital. My estimates go back to 2008, so this is just as much as those come in. The growth rate of human capital per capita used to track that of the United States quite closely. But since 2016, 2017, it's opened up a kind of persistent deficit. And so you can see here that, you know, the last couple of years have not been great nationally. That's the dark green line. But it's been slightly worse here, the red line, which is Minnesota. Now we move on to physical capital, and when you talk about capital, this is really, I think, what people kind of have in mind. This accounts for 37% increases in the per capita stock of physical capital. They account for 37% of Minnesota's per capita GDP growth since 2014, and 35% of the per capita GDP deficit with the United States. Our rate of per worker physical capital growth over that period, 1.2%, ranked 34th. Out of 50 states. Now, I talk about the per worker number here, not the per capita number, because the demographics can change the numbers. So if you've got like an aging population, then you will see that your number per capita number may go down, but your per worker number stays where it is, and it's workers that use this stuff. It's workers that use these tools. That's kind of explaining the thing. We go through here, and you can see here the average annual real change in physical capital per worker over our period. There it is, 1.2%. Oklahoma, Alaska, Wyoming, North Dakota all did pretty badly. Those are big extractive states, and extractives took a bit of a hammering over this period. So you can fairly easily understand what's going on there. Best performer is Florida, then Maine and Utah are doing quite well on this measure. So you have to, why is this the case? Why has Minnesota's performance been what it has been? We performed quite well in the mining sector on job and per worker physical capital growth, but we've done less well in other capital intensive sectors like real estate, rental and leasing, and information. These categories sound a little bit kind of esoteric. These are the Bureau of Labor Statistics and Bureau of Economic Analysis categories in which the data is provided. Again, you can read all about this in the report. But what you'll see here, and this chart is doing an awful lot of work, so I will explain it a little bit closely, is that you see that where Minnesota is doing much better than the national average. So if you look at mining, for example, here, the per worker capital growth in Minnesota is way higher than it has been for the United States generally. But that's actually a very small share of Minnesota's labor force, as you can see from the green line. So we've got this really impressive per worker physical capital performance in this one sector, but it's a small sector. Whereas if you look at some of the other bigger sectors of Minnesota's workforce, we're not doing quite so well, some of the higher, more highly capitalized sectors as well. So you have difficulties there. What I would say is that these average shares of the employment match quite closely in Minnesota and the United States generally. So where you see here that you know, Minnesota's got a huge share in health and social assistance, that's also the case for the United States, which kind of goes back to a point that was made slightly earlier in the previous presentation. At $378,389 per worker, Minnesota's level of per worker physical capital ranks below 23 other states. This chart here shows you that. Again, you'll see it's the extractive states like Alaska and North Dakota that kind of dominate the top up there. Wyoming, which does really badly on a lot of these measures, is up there as well. Again, another extractive state. But if you look at this here, that green line there, there's Minnesota, and you can see that there's really scope for us to increase our physical capital stock and drive faster physical capital and GDP per capita growth from that. So yeah, I think there's scope for us to drive faster growth there also. Our state's growth of per worker physical capital, again, generally tracks that of the United States, but it's not recovered from a stagnation between 2014 and 2020. This is a chart that's like the previous one for human capital, and you'll see that we used to track quite closely, but now a sort of persistent deficit has opened up. You'll see that the growth rate since 2020 has kind of matched that of the United States, but we're still playing catch-up for those lost years. Move on to our last one now, total factor productivity. This accounts for 66% of Minnesota's growth since 2014 in per capita GDP, and 37% of the per capita GDP deficit with the United States. I do believe that we can aim to increase the growth rate of per capita GDP by raising the level of TFP growth here. This is, you know, again, I say, innovation and entrepreneurship. This is calculated as the residual of the equation that we saw at the start of the presentation, so you can't really dig into it the same way that you can with the other components. But you can look back to 2008 and see again that our state used to track TFP growth at the national level fairly closely, but a gap opened up in 2019-2020, which has not been closed. So you can see that here. So let's move on to the conclusions and wrap this up. The first one is that our state has little scope to expand the raw labor components. So I don't think that we're going to drive much faster human capital growth or GDP per capita growth by trying to drive people into the workforce. This is obviously not the case for some subsectors of the workforce. There are some areas where we do have high levels of unemployment or high levels of people out of the labor force, and that's somewhere we could look. But we're not going to, we don't have the capacity that, say, Mississippi does there. This is where immigration of skilled workers would help, because what you want is people coming into your population, because when someone comes in, they increase the GDP and the population part of your GDP per capita equation. So someone who comes in, and it's a question of which they increase more, the numerator or the denominator. And then again, it comes down to their propensity to be employed and the skill level that they have. So the immigration skilled workers would help there. Again, perhaps not a great deal that state policymakers can do with that, although we can look to attract them from other states. I do believe that Minnesota needs to retain and attract more educated workers and those in the prime of their working lives. Those are the people with the highest levels of skills derived from experience. And we should look to boost employment and investment in capital-intensive sectors. Those are sectors where the rates of per capita physical capital, per worker physical capital, are the highest. And we should also look to encourage entrepreneurship and innovation at the state level to boost TFP growth. The million-dollar question is, how do we do this? And to that I can say, watch this space. This is the first start of a multi-part project where I'm now going to use the data that we've constructed to see what impact various state policies can have, either positively or negatively, to boost these components of GDP per capita growth and hopefully get our state moving back up in the right direction. I'll say thank you very much, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. Phelan. I have a question of my own to start things off. Do you have any particular policy recommendations that you would highlight?
The first thing you want to do, so if you move through like human capital, et cetera, if you look at human capital, I do think that we need to be looking at attracting, as I say, skilled workers. Attracting that kind of internationally, there's a lot that you can do about that, or some stuff, you know. I mean, this is a great state to live in. I moved here from a long way away. And so there's a lot that can be done there to attract people, but also from other states as well. And this is perhaps where, you know, the debate begins, because you have to look at what is it that attracts people from one state over another. Now, there's lots of factors that drive migration patterns. The weather is a factor. The amount of lakes and rivers and all the rest of it that you have. The sports teams, unfortunately, may be a factor. So if you look at things like that, you have to look at, rank all these factors and then think to yourself, what are the factors that state policymakers can influence and what are the factors that they can't influence? So, if you think of the weather, there's not much you can do about that, okay? That's just kind of the hand you're dealt. But if you think of things like, tax policy, then you can also, that is something that state policymakers can influence. And there is research that shows that that is a factor in deciding where people choose to live and work. It's not the only factor, and it's not the only fiscal factor. It may also be the case, and this is, a project for one of my future pieces, that people move to where spending is. And so that may be a case as well. So this is something that does need to be looked at more. Generally, when people talk about the impacts of fiscal policy of migration, they only really look at the kind of tax element and not the spending element, which seems kind of only half the story to me. So I think that there's something that could be done. If you look at physical capital, there's a lot less research on this. And it's probably quite true, I think, that people locate physical capital where human capital is high, where skills are high. And so the two things kind of feed into each other there. And also, I would say, if you look at a sector like mining, mining is a very highly capitalized sector. And we should not be, in my view, looking to impede the growth of that sector in Minnesota when we've looked at the data that we've got. At the same time, you shouldn't do a North Dakota and put all your eggs in that basket. Because they are paying the price for that now. You've got to look at kind of a broad-based thing all the way across, I would say.
Well, thank you, Mr. Phelan. Just a follow-up. In your opinion, would it help Minnesota if we held the Winter Olympics every year instead of just once every 4 years?
Possibly. It's got to be worth a try, hasn't it? Why not?
Thank you. I have some questions. Representative Baker.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you, John, for this presentation. This was as deep as a dive as I've ever seen with human capital. That was intensive and a lot of it there. I just want to say that, again, as a small business owner myself, and when myself and co-chair Pinto work on workforce issues and we listen and we talk about what is it that we can do better to get people working and get good paying jobs, that to me is the number one thing that will recruit people to Minnesota and work here. It's when back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s when we were, again, headquarter rich and more rich then, and people were coming here because we had really good jobs to offer. I think what we've learned, what I've learned today, is the education slippage is real here in Minnesota. We're losing young people outside of the state because of educational opportunities. Maybe our expenses are too much for our university system. But what I'm struggling with is we have invested as a state so many millions of dollars to workers that are at risk, young people, people getting out of incarceration, people coming out of substance use disorder. We, through our committee, through our taxes that we are collecting from employers under the workforce fund, the investments have been insane, and it's been a lot. There's a disconnect, though, because the large companies and the ones that can afford to hire more people and more people are not hiring fast enough. We've got people that are getting trained, but we're not hearing them getting kind of to that next level and that second level to do a better job in their income so that our investments in those workers are not paying off like we had hoped they would. Again, we are, I feel like, again, after the Olympics comment, we're on this long marathon that never ends with our competitors, which are 50 other states on the same track. We're losing ground. And I want to make sure we just think about what can we do to help encourage our corporations, our largest and medium-sized companies that can do better for these workers. And I think it's, again, a lot of way it's sort of making sure that we're getting out of the way. It's the old Ronald Reagan economics of get out of the way and people will grow. I'm just so proud to live in this beautiful state that has done so well over the years. But we're losing our edge. We're losing our stride. We're getting complacent. And I think in Minnesota, we have to recognize so many things that makes us great. The immigration stuff is spot on. We need all those people. We need them here to be educated. I want as many of those, and thank God we've had them. Look, at our growth would not be there without our immigrants in Minnesota. But it's not the weather. It is how we encourage investments in Minnesota with our best investors, which are private dollars, private equity. And when they don't see the risks that they would take in Minnesota are better here than other places, they're going to go where the risks are lower. That is the fact. That is how it works. Taxes are important, but it's a lot of other things that come along with that. So, again, more of just a statement. This has been very helpful, but we're losing the race, and we're going to be losing our competitive edge. And every year that goes by when we don't make substantial changes to our policies in Minnesota, in corporate boardrooms and small kitchen tables where people are deciding where to open their business, they go away and they move away under the current rule of our policies. I hope that we can start making those changes sooner than later to make sure that businesses know we care about them, we need them here, and we can't do this without them and their private equity. So, again, I appreciate this, but we are definitely losing our edge. So thank you, John, for this.
Thank you, Representative Baker. I didn't really hear a question in there, so I'm going to move on to Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Phelan, if you could go back to your slide number 3, if you would. And I'll give my question as you're getting there. If you look at years 22 through 24, there are two precipitous drops that happen. Is that in alignment with overall U.S. GDP drop, or particularly in the 22-23-24, that seems to be, in my mind, an important time stamp here in the state of Minnesota with a large tax increase and some other mitigating factors. So that's the first part of my question. Second part of my question, in the interest of time, is your analysis of the, I think it was 23 to 35-year-old range, and then after 35 that seems to evaporate. Is there a correlation in there for people who are making it, I think you said doing well or doing better, are they the ones that are leaving the state and the ones that are behind are the ones that are filling up jobs but at a lower employment rate for thus creating a lower GDP? So two-part question, two ancillary questions.
Yeah, so just make sure that's the chart you're referring to.
Correct.
Okay, so this is just the difference. This is, you know, this is you take Minnesota's level of GDP per capita and subtract the U.S. level. So this is the premium. So if you see a precipitous drop there, it's a precipitous drop in our state relative to the U.S. So whether that's because we did great, we did badly, or the U.S. did great is a bit of both, perhaps. But relatively, you know, it's not good, is what you're seeing there. In terms of the second one, where you're looking at the groups, that's an assumption, you know, that you could quibble with. And I'm giving a presentation on this at an academic conference in a couple of weeks, and I'm sure it will be quibbled with. But what you see when you look at the migration patterns in Minnesota is that we don't lose just retirees. We kind of lose across the board. You know, if you look at the IRS categories, we are a net loser in every age group. It varies, you know, the rates vary across. But we lose in those kind of, you know, 35 to 44 groups, which are obviously the peak years from the skills derived from experience. And so, you know, that's a tricky one, yeah. I hope that answers your question.
Quick follow-up.
Mr. Chair, in a very polite British sort of way, not really, but okay, we'll talk about it offline perhaps. Thank you.
Moving on, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Phelan, I was just going to read a statement from the previous presentation. I'd asked about the labor force participation rate and what percentage of that rate is constituted by part-time workers. And so, you know, I went to the Google, and so I got something here from the Federal Reserve Bank here in Minneapolis. It says, part-time workers make up over 20% of the employed population in Minnesota, with their share of underemployment rising to 63% of that segment by 2025, according to the Federal Reserve Bank. Can you just make a comment on that and how this might figure into our overall GDP? And if you happen to know, and if not, I'll delve into it some more myself, but of those underemployed, what are those people, what's their education level, why are they underemployed? Do you have any data on that, or just any comments on what I just read there?
Yes, yeah, so funny enough, when that was mentioned in the previous presentation, I remembered I wrote something about this and I pulled it up. Unfortunately, it's from 2019. But yeah, Minnesota has one of the higher shares of its workforce in part-time employment. But if you look across the other states that have similarly high shares, you see Utah, Maine, Wisconsin. So these are also states that had high kind of employment ratios that we saw on the chart. So to some extent, you know, the way you get your employment ratio up is perhaps by at the margin by increasing part-time employment. So I don't look at part-time employment and think it's kind of a bad thing. Maybe it's a good thing. You know, the question about being underemployed, I don't know why people are underemployed. I would imagine a lot of it is questions of flexibility. You know, so people who need childcare, things like that would be a guess. Or people who, for whatever reason, they're not able to match, you know, their labor supply with whatever labor demand is in the area. So that would be my answer to that, I hope.
Thank you.
Moving on to Representative Igo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at the conclusions, and thank you again for the presentation, I just wondered if you could elaborate, you know, when I look at my mind as a legislator goes immediately, when I look at these conclusions, okay, what are next steps? And semi-biasedly, as co-chair of housing, I look at this and go, Minnesota has over 100,000 housing units short. So how would we accomplish these conclusions that you're finding to attract people if we don't even have the homes for them? And what are you seeing through your lens as some of the barriers to why Minnesota has come up short on housing over the last couple of years?
Mr. Well, that's a really good point. I was kind of hoping to mention this a little bit earlier on. If anybody, there's another great book, I'm recommending books, a very good book called Abundance by two guys called Ezra Klein and David Thompson, I think. And they make the point that, you know, if you look at California, and these guys are, you know, progressives, they are, I think, the center-left politically, I would say. But they make a point that if you look at California, the place is, you know, a blue state top to bottom. And it should be a state that people can point to and say, you know, if you elect us at the federal level, we'll govern it like California. Instead, these two guys write, Republicans point to California and say, if you elect them, that's what they'll do. And you see this a lot with, you know, things like housing policy particularly. You know, red states, and I calculated this and put it on our website, I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head, red states build far more houses than blue states. You know, that's why house prices are on average lower in red states than they are in blue states. And so if you go to, if you think about, you know, I go to North Dakota quite a bit, and you go to somewhere like Fargo, and you can live like a king in Fargo. You people say, you know, how did the Simpsons afford that house on one blue-collar wage? In North Dakota, you can. You know, it's full of people living the old economy Steve life that you can't necessarily do here. And, you know, there's different reasons for that. Now, one of the things is that if you live in the Twin Cities, you would happily, if you've got an identical house here or in Fargo, say, you would happily pay more for the house here because you've got all these cultural amenities on your doorstep, which, no disrespect, are not necessarily there in Fargo. That becomes problematic when those cultural amenities stop being there. When you sit in your house and you think to yourself, I'm not going to go to the Twins Stadium, I'm not going to go downtown, I'm not going to do this, then you might as well be living in the identical house in Fargo, you know, because, I mean, they've all got a Jimmy John's, right? And so you have to, we talk about how to attract people. One of the things you have to do, and this is when you talk about higher skilled workers, there's a lot of research that shows that cultural amenities are attractive to people. So you kind of need to husband those cultural amenities that you have, look after them and not kind of let them run down and become grotty. And so I think if you're looking, you know, to attract people, that's definitely something that you need to look at. I hope that answers your question.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to the GDP, have you looked at the FRED, the Federal Reserve Economic Data, compared to the data that you have based on inflation adjustment to see where we rank compared to the other states?
This data is pulled from the Bureau of Economic Analysis website, and the FRED data just kind of pulls off that. And the numbers, that these are 2017 inflation-adjusted numbers. So when you look at kind of, I don't think I rank the states by GDP per capita. If I did, we'd actually do quite highly, you know, although we are dropping down towards our average, as I say. But, you know, yeah, so it's adjusted for inflation. So any numbers you see, it's not just. One thing that perhaps is an interesting point about inflation is if you look at regional price parities, you will see we are not actually like a massively expensive state compared to the national average, but we are a lot more expensive compared to North Dakota, say. And I think I crunched the numbers. If you pay someone in North Dakota $80,000, it's the equivalent of paying them like $100,000 here or something, rough numbers. But you can kind of see why, you know, we might be losing to places like that. So I'm a big believer in house building and stuff, you know.
Follow-up, Representative Knorr, quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So looking at that data, it shows that there is a growth in the GDP for the state of Minnesota compared to the other states by upwards of almost 11 to 12%. Is that data that you're tracking based on FRED data?
Mr. Phelan.
The data that I've got kind of shows. So what I do is I look at the kind of national average for GDP per capita in inflation-adjusted terms. And then I take, you know, the average for, or take the amount for Minnesota and subtract the one from the other, again, inflation-adjusted terms. So that it's Minnesota relative to a national average. Relative to other states, you know, we are kind of dipping, obviously, as that happens. I do keep an eye on that, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just kind of curious, too, about seeing some of those 2025 numbers, if there's been any research into why the change in net migration, if it's because of some of the quality of life issues that we, or quality of life that we have here in Minnesota, social programs that we have here that are good for working families. And then the other question that has been really kind of bugging me for quite a while is following up on Representative Scott's question is with part-time people, it would be really interesting to find out how many of those folks who are part-time actually work more than 40 hours a week, and how many of those folks are on publicly subsidized programs, because we know that a lot of these, you know, mega corporations are keeping their folks under 40 hours to avoid paying benefits for them. And so it would be really kind of interesting to see those part-time numbers and see how many of them are actually probably working more than 40 hours with two jobs and then not having benefits at either of them?
Mr. Phelan.
So I'll answer those kind of back to front. In terms of the part-time workers question, I don't have that data, I'm afraid. But I agree it would be an interesting thing to look into. The question of cliffs and all the rest of it, you know, labor supply is a very interesting subject in some respects. The question of why we saw the net in-migration in 2025, these numbers, I think they came out like less than a month ago. So there's not been any kind of specific look into why this is. But yeah, it might actually be all kinds of things. It could be, you know, quality of life. It could be, you know, there's all sorts of reasons people can move. Like I say, taxes aren't the only reason people move somewhere. And, you know, no one thing explains these big net movements. But yeah, it's an interesting subject, and I would look forward to examining it.
Thank you, Mr. Phelan. Representative Frazier, any wrap-up comments and perhaps a preview of our next meeting?
Yeah, and I'll be quick with the wrap-up comments. Thank you, Mr. Phelan, for your presentation. Thank you, Mr. O'Neill, for your presentation. This question probably could have gone to both of you because Mr. O'Neill mentioned it in his presentation. He opened up about how Minnesota kind of the path that we're on kind of started back in the early 70s. Many of you may know the reason for that is the Minnesota Miracle. That was overwhelmingly bipartisan, fiscal legislation that moved us toward where we are today. Now, I can acknowledge if there's things that we need to continue to work on, and Representative Baker said this, we're always going to be in this race, so we're always going to be working to make sure we maintain a competitive edge. But I guess my question would be, considering the history of how we got here foundationally with that Minnesota Miracle and the series of legislation that created that for us as a state, you wouldn't be suggesting that, and the foundation of that was we cared about people, we cared about education, we understood that if we provide resources for individuals to reach their full potential, they would come to this state, they would stay in this state, they would help the state to thrive. Your suggestions, I know you said you've got things coming forward as of what we can do, the answer to continue to move us forward. I was wondering but it wouldn't be a suggestion to move away from that philosophical position that we should do everything we can to make sure people get what they need to reach their full potential.
No, I completely agree with that completely. One of the things that is interesting when you look back at the Minnesota Miracle, what I think a lot of that was people's property taxes were going way up. Inflation was driving people's property taxes up, and people were going crazy about it. Familiar story. And so what the idea there was that you could shift the kind of fiscal burden of local school funding from kind of localities to the kind of state level via this, you know, shifting of taxes and stuff. And I think that's a very sensible idea. You know, the difficulty that you have now is that there are diminishing returns in things. So we increase education spending per pupil or something. And do the results go up? You know, if we look at the test scores, we don't see that, unfortunately. And so it's not a question of being wedded to a particular model of delivery. It's a question of being wedded to an aim and figuring out what's the best way to achieve that, I would say.
The preview, Representative Frazier.
Quick response and a preview.
Very quick.
Very quickly. I would agree around the idea on the property taxes and the measure on whether or not that works in terms of just only looking at test scores. I would disagree with, but we can talk more about that. For a preview, forecast is coming out Friday. That will be the focus of our first hearing when we have the gavel next week, is to walk through that forecast and talk about what it means moving forward.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Frazier. Thank you to the presenters today. Appreciate your being with us. This meeting is adjourned.